Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. I'm your host, Mark Hamilton, joined by my co-host, my colleague. Wow, what a great way to start the podcast. My good friend, Mr. Mark Daly. You know, we've got tons of stuff to get to, but my friend, how the heck are you doing? I know you've had a busy week, so have I. How's it been going?
Oh, man, it's been an insane week, and I just can't wait to put it behind me and get into the weekend. I mean, it is Friday, technically, here. I mean, it's just the dying hours of Thursday night. So the weekend is now, it's large. It's right in the headlights. We can see it in front of us. I just can't wait to get onto it. I mean, it's been a crazy week for both of us. There hasn't been a lot of communication back and forth. I mean, we're usually messaging each other, like, all the time, and this week has been like radio silence. So it's nice to get back and sit down with you tonight and talk about some Formula One and share some laughs and probably some frustrations and, you know, just typical Formula One stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's been one of those weeks, and I think like the world of Formula One, January, February represents something of a tide change in the sport. You see a lot of driver changes, you see executive changes, you see leadership changes, you've seen sponsor changes. It's a busy time, and it's been a busy time at my place of employment, and I was hoping really to get the agenda out to you a couple of days ago. We usually try to get the agenda ready to go by Tuesday, Wednesday. We start massaging it, sharing feedback back and forth. Today, it was thrown together about an hour ago to pull back the curtain on the sausage factory that is this podcast. But it is an exciting time, right? Like, it might feel like we're in the dead of winter. It's January 21st. It is a Friday. Thank goodness. I need the weekend as badly as you do.
No, tell me about
it. But really, when you look at the calendar right now, we're 60 days away from the first Grand Prix in Bahrain. We are just now 20 days away from the first car unveil. So I think since the last time you and I talked, we've had a couple of announcements. Aston Martin is going to drop the AMR 22 on February 10th. That's going to be followed quickly by the McLaren MCL 36 on the 11th. Ferrari, they haven't decided what they're going to call the car yet, but it's going to drop on the 17th. And then on February 18th, Mercedes is going to reveal the AMG F1 W13. So cool. Updates are going to come fast and furious. And you know, 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, we are going to be digesting and processing and talking about seeing some of these 2022 cars for the first time.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, it's funny. I mean, it doesn't really seem like that last race of the season was all that long ago. But then I look, I'm like, oh my God, Christmas was already a month ago. It's just like where did the first month of 2022 go? I've actually gotten into the habit of writing 2022 on all my official correspondences and things like that at work, and that's a win because usually it doesn't kick in till about March. But yeah, the off season is really going quick. So, you know, it's going to be fun. It's going to be great to see all these new cars. And it gets a bit real when you see those dates because, you know, once they go out there and they commit to them, then you know that's something that you just can count on. So, I mean, just days away now, literally, I can't wait. We've been waiting for these reveals for what, 3 years, 4 years now? It's been a really, really long time.
You nailed it. And to recap, and if you weren't on the Spaces chat tonight, we talked about this a little bit. Last year's car reveals were a little bit anticlimactic because most teams effectively physically just carried over their 2020 cars because, of course, the cars that we're going to see in a couple of weeks were the cars that were supposed to be put onto the track for 2021. That was delayed by COVID. So when you talk about we've been waiting years, we have been waiting years. And we got a bit of a teaser from Formula One last year. They were taking around that show car to all of the events. It had that bizarre, crazy, controversial holographic livery. But we're going to see the cars for the first time. And I think what's going to be most exciting about this is looking at the different conclusions the engineers from each of the individual teams drew. Mm-hmm. How do they devise that front wing? How vastly different do the rear wings look? What do the winglets look like? What is the position of the side pods? Like, that's what I'm excited to see. One, the liveries are always cool, but I think it's going to be this time, what kind of conclusions did the individual teams come to when it came to putting together the 2022 cars? And did any of the teams, a la Braun in 2009, come up with something really, really innovative?
You know, a couple of, I guess it's probably back at the beginning of last summer, I went back and started watching some of the historic races from 2009 in the F1 TV archive, I guess is the proper word for it. And it was really cool. I went and watched, I think it was the first two, three races of 2009. And because that's one of the full complete seasons that they actually have in the historical record there. And it really was astonishing how they literally came out of nowhere. Because, I mean, prior to that being Braun GP, that team was Honda. And that team was literally going nowhere fast. And they weren't getting it right. They weren't a super competitive team at all. And honestly, when Braun took over the team and then named it after himself and... They came literally out of nowhere with this world beater. I mean, everybody just sort of sat up and took notice. And then, of course, you know, the story goes that they were taken over and rebranded in Mercedes, and the rest is, as they say, history. But exciting times. I really can't wait to see. So you said Aston Martin's the top of that list currently, right?
Currently, you're absolutely right. So they will drop on February 10th. That doesn't mean that somebody won't precede them, but we just don't know yet. I think by the time we get to recording next week's podcast, we should have a pretty good idea of when all 10 of the individual teams will be dropping their reveal dates. But yeah, right now we've got four, and Aston Martin is currently heading the pack. And that's what I'm excited to see, because obviously 2021, as you and I have discussed so much, was such a bitter disappointment. And I think the other thing that's going to be interesting is they were very excited to bring their green livery to the track last year. Mm-hmm. I think as the team indicated multiple times throughout the campaign, it didn't show up on TV the way they expected. And the other thing that we've discussed or discovered, which we'll talk about a little later in this podcast, is BWT and Aston Martin have gone separate ways. So there won't be any pink on this year's Aston Martin / Racing Point / Force India contender.
Yeah, which is kind of too bad in a way, because, you know, I mean, I don't really have any affinity. We're not being sponsored by BWT. But those pink highlights actually did lend something to the car. So I hope they've picked it out. You know, I hope that they've improved on that color of racing green, because, I mean, that is just, it's a great color. I mean, when you get it right. And that's the thing, though. I remember as a kid growing up, I never really appreciated on the McLarens back in the day. They had the white and like that day-glow orange for the, which is obviously the Marlboro branding. Back in the day when everything was sponsored by tobacco companies, of course, but I never realized for years afterwards, and even in the magazines, it never really translated that, how bright that color actually was. And it wasn't until we were visiting in the UK that we were at a museum or something somewhere where they had one of the recent McLaren cars there, and I was like, oh my god, it's like this day glow orange. And it just, like, I never looked at those cars the same ever since. And I mean, it just it was pretty spectacular. Although it's a little bit to pick up Day Glow Orange on TV, even way back in the day on before, like, definition. Prior to like 4K and, you know, HD and all these things. But the darker shade's definitely a little bit more difficult to pick up on even modern TV.
I feel like that museum, by the way, was Bewley in New Forest, because I think I know the exact same car that you're talking about, and I'm pretty sure I saw it there back in 2010.
And shame on me. Everybody in my family has been to Bewley, and I've been to basically every other museum in the UK, but I've never been to Bewley. I mean, it's top of my list. You know where I think it was at Brooklands, and that's where they still have they have part of the track there. They got a wonderful museum there, and there was a McLaren there, but that might have been... Yeah, I can't remember what year that was. I mean, I was still probably in my teens when I saw it, but I know, shame on me. So anybody listening, take Mark's advice. If you're in the UK and you want to go to an amazing museum, make sure that you look up Bewley, because that is, I've heard the stories, I've seen the pictures, and I just got to get my butt in gear and actually get there. So, hey, before we get into the show itself, we wanted to do some mailbag stuff. You want to do tweets? Or I got one email here that came in over the last couple of days. Where do you want to start? Twitter, email, you choose.
I think you, you'd mentioned before the show that you were excited about the questions. So why don't we go to the email mailbox and start there?
Okay. Well, okay. I'll read this one in its entirety. Hi, Mark and Mark. I'm listening to your podcast since last year when I found out about you guys, and I immediately binged all episodes available on Spotify. Huge fan. I had an interesting thought about the 2022 Carson. Oh, man. I got to back up for a second. He binged the entire episodes on Spotify. He's obviously a huge fan. Thank you so much. That's awesome.
That's some serious commitment.
That is a huge commitment. Anyways, emailer goes on to say, I had an interesting thought about the 2022 cars. So we have this concept of daughter and mother team, where the daughter teams are AlphaTauri and Alfa Romeo, for instance, and the mother teams are Red Bull and Ferrari. Also, the 2022 cars are new and the teams do not have experience with it. This leaves aero philosophy more up to chance. Since the engine is frozen this year, many teams are trying to adapt as best possible to the new aero regulations. There is a chance that these previously slower sister teams are going to come out faster than their mother team just because they get the aero philosophy right. This will lead to interesting conversations on the track, especially, for instance, Red Bull and AlphaTauri. I know that the bigger teams have much higher budgets, etc. However, I still think it is an interesting thought. What do you think about this? Much love from Holland, Timo van Frankenhuizen. P.S. Daily, do you think you can try to pronounce my name right? I've done my very best. You know, I'm English is my first language. Grew up in a Dutch family here, kind of learned it on the side. So, you know, als ik heb het niet goed gezegd, dan krijg je een pilsje van mij. So there's that. Anyways, do you want to dive into that? And Timo, thank you for the awesome email. Love it. And where do you want to break this one down? Because I think he brings up some very, very interesting points. You know, what with the aero regs being completely new and completely unmatched, I guess, in terms of the teams knowing how the other ones are performing. That let's be fair, we don't know how much, you know, communication back and forth there is between, say, Red Bull and AlphaTauri. I mean, the thing is, each team is supposed to build their own unique contender for the championship. But having said that, you know, who knows? I mean, we know that back in the day, a couple of years ago, when they were kind of like shopping around for engines, they had the Honda in the back of the AlphaTauri or the Toro Rosso at the time. They had the Renault and the Red Bull, so they're able to compare data basically one up against another. But I mean, in theory, we really don't know how these cars are going to stack up against each other. There's obviously going to be more distance between an Alfa Romeo and a Ferrari, but still, I mean, I think it kind of goes back to what you were saying in the intro there when we were just kind of talking about things, that the way that the season is shaping up is that there is every chance that one team could completely come out of nowhere and turn some heads.
I totally agree. And I think that's what you and I are probably most excited about, is seeing a couple of surprises on the grid to start the season. And I think the consideration, and I should back this up. One, Timo, thank you so much for all the support in the fantastic email. We don't take anybody's support for granted, and kudos to you for going and working through the back catalog. I would like to think that our wives have a certain affinity or love for us, but I don't think either of them could work through the back catalog of podcasts unless they were being forced to. So
exactly,
thank you
forced.
So much for that. I think the consideration is an important one here when it comes to the 2022 reg. So we're basically pressing reset on everything except the power unit. But the creative license that teams have to develop certain components is tighter than it would have been before. So we won't see the same kind of wild swings in variation that we have before, because the regulations are tighter. They're not going to say something like, hey, you know what, this part can be between 1 millimeter and 100 millimeters wide. It's going to be, this part has to be between 8 and 10 millimeters wide. So the formula is just tighter. The other consideration too is there are far more standardized parts, meaning that teams either have to build a part to an exact specification, meaning that all the teams should build the exact same part, or the teams have to buy the same parts from a standard supplier, as we're going to see with BBS wheels. So as much as I would like to think that we would see an underdog come forward as a surprise contender, not super confident that that's going to happen. It may, and I think it would be super fun. Like, I would love nothing more to see Valtteri Bottas score a podium or score a win in the early part of the season.
That would be amazing, right?
Or something along those lines, but I'm not necessarily super confident we're going to see it, because I just don't think the Formula One regulations as they're now constructed will allow a team to be so far off the mark or so far ahead of the pack. I think the formula is very, very tight, and it was designed that way to avoid this vast spectrum of competitiveness on the calendar.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the fun things to look forward to in 22 is all these, you know, all the unknowns, like I said, and just the fact that, you know, it's going to be fun. Anyways, Timo Badank for the email, Johan. Okay, let's go to Twitter. What do we have in the Twitter inbox? Because I guess it's not really a mailbag, is it, when it comes to Twitters?
This question's pretty a clear reflection that we probably spend too much time talking about the weather here in Vancouver. But this comes from Zach, and not the Zach that traditionally reaches out and shows us lots of support. Yep. Although, suspiciously, our good friend Zach hasn't reached out in a while, so we would love to hear from you, Zach. Hopefully, you're listening to this podcast at work and it's helping you pass the time. But from this Zach, you guys live in Canada, and I assume you're buried in snow for 4 months each winter. How do you pass the off season without Formula One?
Well, I mean, let's just clear up something here. We live in Vancouver, which is like the one part of Canada that literally gets like zero snow. I mean, if you think, you know, if you're familiar with the Pacific Northwest and say Seattle, Portland, and that part of the United States, especially Seattle being a little bit further north than Portland, the one thing that that people talk about there all the time is rain during the winter. So we get just about as much rain, and then you can go 100 miles east of here, and then, you know, it turns into a winter wonderland. But having said that, we're usually good for one or two big dumps of snow every winter. And this past month, I mean, we basically kicked off the winter to with some fanfare. I mean, it got very cold over the Christmas holiday break there. We had a lot of snow, and especially where I live, just a little bit higher up on the mountain. I mean, we had probably a couple of feet of snow by the time it was all done. And I mean, in the past 2 weeks, we've kind of reverted back to our mild, wet, and soggy West Coast winter. So everything's all rapidly melted. But I mean, honestly, the way that I try and survive the off season is, you know, as much as I love Formula One, I've got a lot of different interests going on. I've got, work keeps me busy. Family keeps me busy. I've got a part-time career in the military that keeps me busy. I love sports. NFL Wildcard Weekend was going on last week. So that was good fun. And I ski, I bike. There's, I'm one of these people that work actually gets in the way of my my interests. And I know you're the same way, Mark. I think if we were independently wealthy, then, neither you or I would be pressed to find ways to spend our time.
Yeah, no way at all. I always forget about your involvement in the military, and now I feel bad for constantly joking about being a high-flying drug dealer in our neighborhood. It's super inappropriate now that I think about it. I think...
Don't worry, I'm not ATF, man.
One thing to consider that is that while it's not super cold where we are, the winters are very similar to Portland and Seattle, our winters are incredibly dark. It's dark until 9 a.m., it's dark at 4 p.m., and the days are typically overcast and gray. So I think the struggle for us is finding things to do indoors in the winter to help pass the time and to not get to suffer from too much seasonal depression because of the darkness. So I think very similar to you, tons of activities. I've got my son. I've always been a big runner. I love to run. Yep. I love to consume podcasts. It's where I get all my sports news. The podcast takes up a good chunk of time, not as much as I would love to commit to it.
Oh, same.
So it's really just about finding hobbies and things like that. I struggle with TV shows. Like, I love TV and I love movies. I struggle to be able to commit to a TV show or a movie, but there's probably 100 TV shows that I would love to go back and binge and enjoy. And ever since we've had our son, we haven't been able to watch a ton of really great movies because he's typically just around. Like, he's more of a roommate to us than he is a son. So if we're up at 10 p.m. watching a movie, he's sitting there beside us doing something. So it's difficult to watch any adult-themed films, but... But other than that, that's a good question. Thanks for asking, Zach.
I got a question for you then. What is the last series that you watched? Like, either streamed or watched on TV, whatever it was. Well, you don't have cable, do you?
So no, we cut the cord long ago, but we certainly subscribe to a lot of streaming platforms. Same. So we have Disney Plus, which I love. We have Netflix, which is really good. We have Amazon Prime. I want desperately to subscribe to Crave. A couple of the shows that I do need to finish. I loved Power. I haven't finished the last season. I haven't started the spinoff, but I absolutely adored Power. Billions, I loved. We're a couple seasons behind on that. In terms of shows I did finish, like last summer, I actually got a running injury, so I had to switch to a stationary bike. So in the fall, I binged over the course of a couple of months every episode of the Trailer Park Boys, and now I'm watching Grown-ish on Disney Plus. But But yeah, that's kind of what I've been going through lately.
Cool, cool. Yeah, you know, I'm also, I love to read. I've got an e-reader, which goes with me everywhere. And the one series I just finished binging was The Wheel of Time on Amazon Prime, because I've read all the books and now I'm watching the series, and I'm done season one. And, you know, there's like 11 more seasons to come if they pull it together. Anyways.
So I have to ask you. So I was talking to friend of the show, Josh Cooper, before we kicked off, and he was talking about some of the really great books he's been reading. I was like, dude, you're super busy. You've got a family. How do you find time to read? And I think for me, I probably do have time, but I end up just scrolling through in social media on my phone instead of being something productive. How do you find time to read? You've got a big family. You've got multiple jobs. You've got multiple hobbies.
Yeah, it's just basically, I mean, that's where the e-reader is great, because, you know, that's the thing, is because, you know, being somebody that has trouble focusing on things, you know, I can't read one book at a time. So I just, that's why I love the e-reader, because I can have all the books I'm reading and I just pick it up and literally 15 minutes coffee break at work, boom, out comes the e-reader. You know, I'm just sitting down and got 15, 20 minutes after dinner, boom, out comes the e-reader. Just break off a couple of chapters and then, or whatever time allows, and go on to the next one, because we all know that, you know, this is the anchor around our neck that demands all the attention, but, you know, we enjoy it, so it's all good. All right. So what's the next question in the mail? Oh, actually, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll do some more tweets. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right. Well, welcome back to the podcast. It is always Up to Speed with Formula One, and it's Mark and Mark here, and we're reading tweets and emails. So we got a couple of those under our belt. What's up next then?
I think the next one, and this one's targeted a little bit towards me, I guess, because I'm assuming this individual probably knows where I work and what I do, but it says, Hamilton, I know you're big into technology and work at blank blank. Can you recommend a big screen TV to optimize my F1 viewing this year? Oh boy, can I. So I think it really depends on your budget. But obviously, if you want to get really immersed in F1, it's not enough just to have a big screen TV. You want to have a really great soundbar, some surround speakers, and a subwoofer. If you can pull that off and your partner, your significant other is okay with it. But my recommendation is that if you can pull it, if you can make it work, both LG and Sony offer some really, really great OLED televisions. Mm. OLED provides tremendous contrast and true inky blacks. They effectively have the ability to turn off pixels when they're not being used. So if there's a black scene, they just turn off the pixel, so you don't get a lot of grayish, bluish kind of schmarminess on the screen. So sure. I would recommend, if you're looking to buy a TV, look at LG, look at Sony. I would highly recommend Sony over OLED. I've had a Sony OLED now for almost 5 years and we absolutely love it. Samsung at CES a couple of weeks ago announced that they will be releasing their own line of OLED TVs later this year. And I believe Sony's actually going to incorporate the Samsung OLED panels into their TVs, or at least part of their lineup. So that should be exciting to look for. But if money's not necessarily an object and you can spare $1,000 to $1,500 US, or say $14,000 to $2,000 Canadian, I would say OLED's the way to go. And I think a lot of the image retention or burn-in issues of the early units from, say, 2015, 2016, those have largely been addressed. So probably no major issues there.
Nice. So what do you think for like a complete setup then? You know, let's go the Gucci routes where, you know, we're kind of top of the line everything. What do you expect that would set somebody back?
Yeah, so I think that's an awesome question. And I have to be cautious because I love our system a lot, but we also got really great staff purchases on all of the equipment that we have. So
sure.
I have to appreciate that for somebody walking in off the street, it might not be quite so easy, but I think an OLED panel, my recommendation would be a Sony TV. Pair that with the 4K Apple TV. The absolutely amazing F1 TV Pro app is now native to that device.
Yep.
You don't have to AirPlay. You don't have to stream it. You don't have to mirror your phone or your tablet. You can play it natively. Mm-hmm. They don't have 4K streaming content yet, but the 1080p 50s, pretty darn good.
It's pretty solid.
Baseline.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's getting better, and I look forward to the day they finally reveal 4K streaming. But in terms of an audio setup, if you can pull it, my recommendation is to keep it clean. Do not go with wires. Do not go with a stereo receiver. Go with a Sonos soundbar, the Playbar, or the newer Atmos Playbar, and just pair that with a couple of Sonos Ones, which are the small ones that can act as your surround speakers. And then eventually, if you can pull it, the Sonos Sub. So for me, it's a Sony TV paired with a Sonos 5.1 system. You've got no wires. It's super clean.
Nice.
And the benefit of the Sonos speakers too is you can AirPlay directly to them from your phone or your tablet. So if you're not using it for a home theater setup or to watch Formula One, you can just AirPlay directly from your device to the speakers for audio immersion or whatever the case might be, or even for a party.
Dude, you know, I just feel like we should just break the show off right here. I feel like I got to do some browsing now online. So let's go to the next tweet, because this could get very expensive all of a sudden.
Here's a tweet. I'm going to kick this one over to you.
Okay.
And it's one that I didn't get on the agenda, but it came in right before we started the podcast.
Oh, I get nervous about
these
ones.
This one's from Jake.
That's off script.
No, this is a good one.
Okay.
I think you'll be good. The question's from Jake, and Jake's question is, hey guys, I started a podcast recently, in brackets, not Formula One, and I spend hours and hours preparing for the podcast and many hours editing the podcast after we've recorded. How do you guys do it every single week? How much time do you spend prepping, and how much time do you spend in post, so post-production, getting the recording ready after the podcast is done? You guys do a great job. I tune in every single week. Thank you so much, Jake.
Oh man, so basically I don't let my kids sleep. I make them come down here and do all the post, all the prep, and you know, Mark and I are upstairs just chilling and just you know laughing evilly. But you know, seriously, you know, Jake, you know, it's what you put into it, and there's just, you know, what you see and what you hear. I mean, for the people watching the live stream, for those of you listening to the podcast right now, this is the end result. I mean, there's probably three times the amount of work goes into prepping and to post, at least. So I would say that's probably the ratio is about 3 to 1 of work compared to. So for every 1 hour that you hear or watch, that there's, you know, 2 to 3 hours minimum of work in the background. And, you know, the thing is that you'll find that the more you do it, you'll kind of get your own system, you'll get your own kind of workflow, and you'll get efficient with that. But the thing is, it's, you know, what you put into it is what you get out of it. And, you know, Mark and I were very much on the same page when it comes to things like production quality and just the overall script and the flow of the show. And Jorge and I were like that when we started the other podcast that we ran for a number of years. It covered Major League Soccer and the Vancouver Whitecaps. We thought we could have the best content ever, but if the show sounds like garbage, the audio quality is terrible, then nobody's going to listen to it, because they won't be able to stand the show and listen to it for more than a couple of minutes. So, I mean, we spent a lot of time learning audio production and learning about microphones and all these different things to basically build it up from the ground up. You know, I've gotten to a point now where I'm comfortable with doing it. And, you know, Mark is too, from, you know, his parallel experience before we partnered up, over, what was it, a year and a half ago now, whatever it is. I mean, time flies. But I wish there was some easy way, some, you know, magic app or some way you could snap the fingers. But, you know, my advice and my suggestion, and I'm sure Mark will, you know, echo this, is just, you know, focus on it. You know, just do what you do. Do what, you know, makes you awesome. Focus on that. Focus on the production, and just make sure that you keep the comment or the content coming. Because don't hit your audience with like 2 episodes a week, and then don't drop anything for 3 months, or, you know, do it every week. Whatever it is, just, you know, once you get your community built, make sure you know keep it coming, because those are the people that you're doing it for, and that's what makes it fun.
The only thing I would add, and I think all of that is perfect, is the post-production is infinitely easier if you prep well and the recording goes smoothly.
True.
You will spend an infinite and endless amount of time in production if you have a really choppy, if you have a really choppy recording. Mm-hmm. One thing that we do that actually surprises a lot of people, although probably not the people that join us on YouTube to watch the stream every week, is, as you would say, this is live to tape.
Yeah.
Is that the expression?
Yeah, in radio, this is what's...
We hit record.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what's known as live to tape. I mean, if we were doing this, you know, on the radio, it basically, the mics would go hot, you know, all the lights would go red in the studio and all the on-air signs would go on. And that's basically how we do. We don't edit out we don't edit out anything. So, I mean, basically what you hear is what you get. I mean, the only difference between the podcast and the live stream is that when we say we break for these commercials, which, you know, we have to do with the, with our provider, is we basically leave about 4 or 5 seconds of dead air. And if they have you know, an advert to fill, then those ad markers go later on. So sometimes you hear that in the podcast, or sometimes you just hear a bit of dead air, but that's about the only thing. So what we do at the end is we edit it in its entirety. We run it through our own secret recipe of post-production and to tidy up the audio, and then we fire it together, and that's what you get. But I mean, YouTube gets everything in its entirety and all its you know, but I mean, there honestly isn't really a big difference between them, but yeah, that's a thing. Yeah,
cool. Great question.
Yeah, that was a great question.
Should we get into the news, given that we market ourselves as an F1 news podcast, and here we are an hour later?
That's right. Okay. Well, actually, why don't we break early here, and then now we can go for a nice long section and segment and talk about Formula One. So guys, don't go away. We got a short break for a message from our sponsor, so don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
5-1-0, declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Okay, well, welcome back, and here we go. Finally, 30 minutes into this thing, we're actually going to talk about some Formula One. Although we did a little bit here and there in the first couple of segments, but hey, it's off season. You know, we're kind of talking about a lot of the things that we don't get to sometimes during the rest of the year, but that's it's all fun. So big news this week, of course, is, well, I mean, last week there was big news because Aston Martin and Otmar Szafnauer, former team principal, parted ways. This week, they make the announcements that... In very short order, I was very surprised that this was announced so fast, but Aston Martin has announced Szafnauer's replacement, and that's former BMW Motorsports heads Mike Krack, and he takes over at the big job there, and I was a bit surprised. I must be honest with you, I'm not very familiar with Krack. I know that he headed up the BMW's global motorsport operations since about 2014, 2015. So that meant he was in charge of the Formula E, GT, and IMSA programs, and then oversaw the expansion of their new LMDH category. Prior to that, he spent a couple of years with Porsche as head of track and engineering for their LMP1 project. And, well, I mean, there is one Formula One tie-in, because when he was at Porsche, he was actually working alongside McLaren's team principal, Andreas Seidel. So, anyways, he does have some Formula One experience. He worked at Sauber and then BM Sauber, pardon me, way back in the day. And he was actually worked as an engineer with Sebastian Vettel when he was with Sauber way back in the day. So, anyways, Krack had to say, quote, "It is a thrill and an honor to have been appointed to the position of team principal of Aston Martin. I'm very grateful to Lawrence Stroll and Martin Whitmarsh for giving me such a fantastic opportunity. Aston Martin is one of the greatest automotive brands in the world, and to have been asked to play a leading role in delivering the on-track Formula One success that such an illustrious name so richly deserves is a challenge that I plan to embrace with energy and enthusiasm," end quote. So there you go. What do you make of this signing, Mark? It's an interesting one, is it not?
It happened. Yeah, it feels like this was all orchestrated months
ago. Totally.
We talked about back in the fall that there was a leak, there was a story, there were reports that Otmar was going to be leaving Aston Martin to join Alpine. Everyone quickly dismissed that. It's not true, it's not true, it's not true. Yep. The season ends, and almost unceremoniously, Otmar is out the door, despite the fact that he'd been with that organization since 2009, had seen it through administration, had seen it through rocky ownership, had done a great job of building relationships with sponsors, including BWT. But to me, this just goes back to last fall when Whit Marsh was signed by Lawrence Stroll to head up the Aston Martin division. And I think questions started being asked immediately about what the relationship was going to be between Otmar and Whit Marsh. And I think people close to the organization as well had sensed or believed that maybe Otmar was in a position for a promotion, not in a position in his career at this stage where he was suddenly going to be taking marching orders from Whit Marsh. And I think it became pretty untenable within that organization. And clearly, Lawrence had some degree of trust in Whit Marsh to make this happen. Now, in this case, I think the hiring is, like you said, that this individual has no experience as a team principal, has no experience running a Formula One team. I think that this is part of Whit Marsh's master plan, that he wants somebody that's going to be willing to take marching orders from him and isn't going to demand a great deal of autonomy in terms of operating the Formula One team. And I think Whit Marsh knows what he's signing up for. And says Lawrence Stroll, and I'll quote here, "We are about to embark on year two of our five-year plan, the objective of which is to win Formula One World Championships. Mm-hmm. All the ingredients we require are coming together. Mike will play a central and leading role reporting to Martin Whit Marsh, Aston Martin Group Chief Executive Officer in brackets, and leading our technical and operational functions. Our collective aim being to fulfill those lofty ambitions. We are on our way." I think in the paddock and I think in the fan community, there's a lot of love for Otmar. So I'm a little mixed on this move because I feel like Otmar had extracted everything that was possible from this organization for many years.
Well, I think that he did a great job in the time that he was there and the various iterations of Aston Martin / Racing Point / Force India. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But I mean, this whole appointment of Krack really feels to me like it was he was headhunted. He was the guy that they wanted. And it was just finding a way to, you know, finagle him and work him into the organization. So it was as surprised as I was that they parted with Otmar, I was equally as surprised that they announced a replacement so quickly. But, you know, what was surprising to me as well this week is that they have snatched away Red Bull's former head of aerodynamics, a fellow by the name of Dan Fallows. That was a bit of an odd transition there. Anyways, Dan will become their new technical director at Aston Martin in April after Aston Martin Red Bull actually reached an agreement about his notice period and the fact that Mr. Fallows will not have to spend an extended period of gardening leave at his at home. So he'll be able to get going pretty quick. And Aston Martin Group Chief Executive Martin Whit Marsh. Wow, that is a mouthful for a job title, is it not? Wow, Mr. Whit Marsh. Wow, he must have like the big extra large size business card for that. Anyways, Whit Marsh had to say, quote, "We are pleased to have reached an agreement with Red Bull, which releases Dan early from his contract and are looking forward to him joining the team," end quote. On the other side, on the flip side, Christian Horner, team principal at Red Bull, said, quote, "We would like to thank Dan for his many years of excellent service and wish him well for the future," end quote. So, you know, kind of a generic thing. And Dan Fallows himself said, quote, "I've enjoyed many happy years at Red Bull Racing and proud of what we achieved. I'm looking forward to next season and a new challenge," end quote. You know, I'd be interested to find out. I'm not immediately familiar with him and his career and how much time he spent at Red Bull, but I get the the impression that he has been there for quite some time. I wonder if he goes back to the championship years, you know, a decade ago with Sebastian Vettel and the four world titles that they pulled off then, and then Max's world title. Yes, I know that that's still a debate for a lot of people, but moving on from that, maybe he just felt that was the perfect time to walk away from the organization and move over to a team that obviously has some very big ambitions Obviously, Aston Martin, one of the most well-known marks of automobile in the entire world. I could see the attraction of trying to go there. And obviously, Lawrence Stroll makes, I think, one heck of a good sales pitch, not in just what they want to do, but to the fact that he's invested so much of his own money into this project, into this company. You know, obviously shows people who are serious about motorsport, who are pros, are obviously going for that pitch because, you know, they're the real deal. So when you see some big names and, or, you know, maybe not necessarily big names, but very qualified people going to a team like Aston Martin, it kind of gets me excited again that they're going to get it right at some point and design a winning car, or at least a very, you know, a good challenger. Let's put it that way.
I have a bit of a sense that there's a lot of excitement in the world of Formula One about having the opportunity to work for Aston Martin. I think people look at that team and they see the money that Stroll is investing, and they see the facilities that are sprouting up in the shadows of Silverstone. And I think for a lot of people, they want to be a part of that. And for Dan, I think given how long he's been with Red Bull, and he actually joined Red Bull back in 2006, he started as an aerodynamics team lead. He led the aerodynamics department up to 2014. During that period, of course, is when Sebastian Vettel won all of those titles. So there's some strong linkages there between Dan and Sebastian Vettel. But I just think it comes down to opportunity, the anonymity to be able to lead a department and to be able to make chief critical decisions. But I think this is a good move, and obviously it's going to be a blow for the Red Bull team. But that said, all of the heavy lifting in terms of getting the 2022 car done and ready is already finished. Mm-hmm. That his work effort there is done. The car is done. And we know that there won't be significant innovation and change to these cars over the next couple of years simply because the formula won't allow it. So his contributions to Red Bull are largely finished at this point. Mm-hmm. I think his role at Aston Martin is really going to be trimming and modifying and tweaking whatever the 2022 car is that they came up with prior to his arrival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great move and a great signing for Aston Martin. So it'll be it's going to be fun to watch and see where this team develops. And I mean, it can't get much worse than last year. I mean, we talked about it almost ad nauseum over the past season. How big our expectations were for them based on what they did in 2020. And then they largely fell flat and frustrated us all season long. But, you know, that's actually a good segue for the next story, frustration being the common theme here. And that is Marcin Budkowski, who was the executive director at Alpine, has left the team. And it seems like every year they seem to, you know, split ways with top level people within that organization. I mean, this is a team formerly known as Renault who have been in the sport. When did they come back in after? Was it 2015? Yeah, after they bought out the Lotus team and then rebranded and all that. So it is, you know, it just continually frustrates me that they can't get it right. And you think every time that they bring in a new regime and they bring in new people, you always think, or at least I think, okay, now it looks like they've got people in place. Now they might be able to get this project point in the right direction. And I just feel like we're caught in this vicious cycle. It just seems that it's like COVID. It just never seems to get any better. I mean, that's a horrible way to compare, like a thing to compare Alpine to, but I mean, you get what I'm saying, is that they just, they're stuck in this vicious cycle and it just never seems to improve with them, and they just seem to be floundering.
You stole all of my thunder, and I won't repeat everything you just said due to the duplication of efforts. But yeah, I completely agree. It just seems that this team constantly churns out talent at the top. And remember, mm-hmm. it was only a year ago that we were talking about Cyril Abitbol being shown the door mm-hmm. at Renault, then becoming Alpine. And I think the assumption at that point was that Budkowski, having just come over from the FIA a couple of years ago, where he was deeply integrated into the technical department. Yeah. I think the assumption last year was that, hey, with Cyril out the door, he's going to be promoted to team principal. But he ended up in this weird collaborative position where he was co-running the team. He was informally the team principal and was an acting team principal, but wasn't getting paid and didn't have the title of team principal. And then it began to leak that, of course, Mr. Rossi, team CEO or Alpine CEO, was heavily involved in the decision-making of the team. To me, it just, it's got my head spinning a little bit that if you want to build something, you need some degree of stability, and you can't just have a turnstile of people coming and going constantly, which is what this seems to be. And it's funny because I saw a tweet or a message on Reddit when I was reading some of the comments about this, and this is horrible, and please don't take this as me reflecting poorly on any type of stereotype, but somebody had made this great comment that obviously the Alpine team is part of the broader Renault family, and the Renault company is partly state-owned. So you have this Formula One team that is an extension of their very kind of exclusive prestige, but low sales volume performance arm, but it's part of a much bigger, partly state-owned company. And it was just reflecting on the fact that there's this sheer massive volume of bureaucracy and middle management throughout all of Renault, and there's a lack of stability sometimes, and that there's a lack of concrete decision making because people aren't necessarily willing to make those risky decisions, and you just end up with this churn of middle managers, and it just doesn't lead to any degree of stability or excellence. And unfortunately, that's what we're starting to see here.
Well, you know, I mean, talk about this turnstile of people leaving. Four-time world champion Alain Prost, who has been a advisor to the team over the past several years. I mean, he drove for Renault way back in the early 1980s for a couple of seasons early in his career. He's split from the team, and well, he was not very happy about the way that it was announced. He wrote on his Instagram, quote, "I am very disappointed how this news has been announced. It was agreed that we would announce together with Alpine F1 team. No respect, sorry. I have refused the offer you made to me in Abu Dhabi for the 2022 season because of a personal relationship, and I was right. To the Enstone and Viri team, I will miss you," end quote. So Prost obviously not very happy about that, and a little bit salty about the way that it has gone down. And you know, the interesting thing is now is that apparently we're kind of going a little bit to a full circle here, is that the speculation is that Otmar Szafnauer might actually join the team, and he has the relationship with the BWT, the water company that have sponsored Aston Martin / Racing Point for the past couple of years. And it just depends where you're getting your news from. Some sources say it sounds like it's a done deal that that Szafnauer is going to become, is going to Alpine. He's bringing BWT with him. And then some other sources are a little bit more vague, a little bit non-committal, saying that, he hasn't really clearly indicated what his next move is going to be in Formula One or wherever it might be. So it's just a bit of a messy situation all around. And, personally, I like Otmar Szafnauer, pardon me, and I just hope that if he ends up going there, I just hope he goes into the situation with eyes wide open.
I completely agree.
You know, I think there's that organization. I think it's just full of politics and machinations and all sorts of things. And I think that to go from a very small kind of really family run team, almost in the sense that Force India was. I know this. It's probably expanded and grown a little bit since Lawrence Stroll got involved, but I mean, going from that Force India background to like the Alpine / Renault behemoth, I think is going to be a completely different experience. And I hope if he does go there, that it works out for him. Let's just say that.
Mr. Daly, can I please pour out some tea for our younger listeners real quick on this topic?
Go for it. Yes, please.
So this is interesting. So Alain Prost, four-time world champion, the greatest French F1 driver of all time. I don't think that's debatable.
Nope.
He'd been in certain capacities with the Alpine / Renault team really since their re-entry into Formula One. Originally, it was more of a kind of a celebratory role. Then it became a formal director role, but non-executive director role. It's become pretty clear in the last few weeks, in the last few months, that his beef with that team was specifically with Alpine CEO Rossi. Mm-hmm. And says Alain Prost, and I'm quoting here, he commented that Rossi, quote unquote, wants to be alone and quote unquote, wants all the light. And furthermore, says Prost, it's a question of respect. Relationships become more and more complicated. I felt that there was a lot of jealousy, inferring that Rossi was jealous of Prost's presence within the team. Now, during, and again, I want to be careful here that I'm not kind of shading Rossi as this tyrannical monster because we're not getting his side of the story here. It could very much be that Rossi sees that, hey, this is a team that's really broken and we've got some poor leaders and I've got to clean house and start over. And of course, he's never going to be able to come out on Twitter and kind of fight back on what Prost is saying, that he's in this difficult position where he's still in the role, he's still a professional, he has to kind of turn a blind eye to all of this. Mm-hmm. But somebody did mention during our Spaces chat tonight, and I had completely forgotten this, that Alain Prost once owned a Formula One team.
Almost
immediately after he took ownership of the team, it all but cratered in terms of on-track performance and in terms of financial viability. So it's also very possible that Alain Prost just wasn't delivering what they were hoping he would deliver as a director within that organization. And I don't know this. I just want to make sure that I'm not throwing too much shade at Rossi when he doesn't get to tell his side of the story due to his professional circumstances.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. No, just remind me for a moment here. So the Prost F1 team was named Prost. Did he take over Ligier? Was that how that went? It was, right?
That was it, yep.
Yeah, okay. Yep. So that's going back quite a while. And I mean, the only race that I think Ligier ever won was back in the mid-90s when Olivier Panis, also a French driver, won at Monaco. Do you remember, like, after that race, I think maybe there was some sort of, like, photo or media op afterwards where he actually drove around in the streets of Monaco in his car. I specifically remember it without a crash helmet on or anything. It's just like, oh, yeah, I'm just out for a drive in my Formula One car. I mean, it was pretty cool, but, you know, it was kind of funny at the same time, a little bit surreal. I mean, I'm sure you can search that up on Google or whatever, find some pictures of that. Olivier Panis, P-A-N-I-S. You know, so anyways. Okay, well, let's go on to the next one. Next story, what do we have here? Williams. So they've also split with somebody this week. They have parted ways with their engineering director, Adam Carter, who's been with the team since 2016 and basically took control of the mess that was left when Paddy Lowe left at the beginning of 2019. I mean, is that still not one of the most bizarre and anticlimactic and just, I never expected that team to crater the way that they did when Paddy Lowe went there. I mean, he was a guy that would have been in Mercedes. I mean, he was like, I thought at the time when he was going to go from the Mercedes to Williams, I thought this is a great move. And I mean, it was, I never thought it would turn out to be the disaster. And we don't need to sugarcoat it because it was a disaster. And I mean, they are still suffering from that because, I mean, they were basically a best of the rest kind of team prior to 2017. I mean, yeah. It's just the way it was, right?
Well, let's go back to 2014. So 2014 was the new era. It was the first year with the turbo hybrids.
Yep.
Williams, and this is unfathomable today, they finished third in the Constructors' Championship, and their drivers, including Valtteri Bottas, were regularly scoring podiums.
Yep.
They were scoring podiums in 15, 16. They even scored a podium, and again, the circumstances were pretty unique, but Lance Stroll scored that wild podium in Baku 2017.
Yeah. Great point,
but
yeah.
But it just... The challenge with Formula One, especially with a role like the one Paddy had, is it's not like the NBA or the NHL where you've got a bad coach and he's struggling and you fire that coach and you get a new coach comes in and he rebuilds the culture and he rebuilds the system and you make a couple of trades. When you've instituted the design philosophies of an individual like Paddy Lowe for years and years and years, you're building a 2 or 3 year runway. So even though they'd fired him, their runway in terms of the design and construction of that car was cemented for 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So even after he's gone, you are stuck to what he had built. So he's gone in 2019, but they're basically stuck for that car with 2020. And then they carried the 2020 car over to 2021. It's miraculous that they were able to make the development and the advancements that they did do in 21. But I would love, because I never expected that, I would love for somebody to do a deep dive and write a long form article or a book on what went wrong when Paddy was there. Was it a power struggle with Frank? Was it that this team simply didn't have the resources? Was it that the organization was as compartmentalized and broken as it's been reported? I don't know. I would love to know.
You know, I've never been to Grove and been to the factory or to the design office. I mean, you have. I mean, what was your impression? I mean, it's one thing to be a visitor, but what was your impression when you were there? Just the overall size of the operation that they have.
So the scale was big. And I think even by modern F1 standards, the scale was certainly quite large. It's a big facility. You can see the wind tunnel from the street. But at the same time, there was a sense of, I'm trying to choose the correct words for this. The factory is based on the edge of a small village in the countryside. So it's a picturesque setting. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But when you show up to the gate and you go through security, it's a very homely, welcoming, intimate environment. And everyone that I've ever interacted with there, they seem extremely friendly. They're very welcoming. And then again, if you're a fan like me that goes to the factory, you're generally dealing with people that work in hospitality. They're there specifically to deliver that type of experience. But from everything I've seen, at least from a facilities perspective, they seem to be world class, to be totally honest. And mm-hmm. I've driven through Brixworth, I've driven through Braxworth, I've seen the Red Bull facility. It's a big facility. Now, what's actually happening within those facilities and in the design offices and where they're machining parts and where they're operating the wind tunnel, you don't get to see a lot of that. So it's very possible that, hey, maybe structurally they're sound, but everything that's happening inside those structures is broken or simply underfunded.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, it's kind of an interesting story here too, what with Carter leaving, but it's not like there's a big void because last year their new team principal, Jos Capito, actually recruited a new technical chief, a fellow by the name of François Xavier de Maison. And so he's there. So this just sounds almost to the point that that Carter's role with the team just became a little bit redundant. It sounded like that they went out and Capito found somebody that ticked all the boxes for the role and the vision that that he has for the team. So it'll be another team that we have to keep an eye on, because I have a big soft spot for Williams. I was a huge fan of Nigel Mansell when I was a kid growing up, and I was a big fan of Damon Hill. Not so much of JV, but, you know, I mean, I guess there's the Canadian connection there, but, you know, they were a winning team. They were a great team. I went back, I mentioned off the top of the show, I went and watched the 2009 season on F1 TV. I actually went back and I think they had the 1986 or the 87 British Grand Prix. It was Nigel Mansell and Nelson Piquet in the Williams. I think it was the FW11 Honda turbocharged engine, and it was crazy. They were lapping cars after like 10 laps. I mean, McLaren, that was about a year or so before they really became the force in Formula One, and it was kind of going back and forth. I mean, we talk about these days Red Bull and Mercedes, but back then, late 80s, it was Williams and McLaren. But I mean, that was just crazy. And then, of course, we had turbocharged cars, we had the normally aspirated cars, we had two championships effectively. We had the main world championships, and then we had a championship, and then we had, I think they called it like the Jim Clark Cup for basically the best of the normally aspirated cars. But then, you know, of course you had all these cars sort of intermixed, right? And I couldn't believe it. Like I say, they were lapping cars after like literally 10 laps. It was crazy stuff. Anyways, what do you have there? You're holding something up that we can see on camera, but maybe explain it for the benefit of everybody listening on the podcast.
It was actually sitting on the desk next to me. This was a souvenir I actually picked up at Grove. This is a gear out of the gearbox from a 2005 Williams Formula One car.
Oh, cool.
I can't remember which of the two cars it was in, but when I bought it, it was in, they kind of had this nice kind of setup where you can buy souvenirs and things like that. But mm-hmm. to be able to buy a piece out of a car was pretty cool. And it's neat because it's actually got a light, it's kind of a serial number on it, and it's got some etchings. But one of the cool things about this, and they talk about this when you're there, is every single piece in their car has a predetermined mileage. So when you put a specific piece in a car, like a gear in a gearbox, they actually record that in their computer system. So they'll know this gear went in on this day and it's had, say, 170 kilometers of mileage, it needs to be serviced, or it's got 1700 kilometers on it. That's past the threshold for suitable performance. We're going to pull it out. So this piece had gone in. You can see there's a little bit of wear on mm-hmm. the teeth, and ultimately it would have been deemed no longer worthy from a performance perspective. But when I actually bought it, it still had fluid on on it, like actual lubricant on it. So I should have kept it on, but I did wipe it off. But yeah, one of my favorite little souvenirs.
That's cool. But you know, the way that they maintain these cars, and sometimes, you know, I say cars with like the inverted commas around them. I mean, the maintenance is almost like for like aircraft or something like that. It really is amazing.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's see. Where are we now? Let's take another quick break. We'll come back. And this next one, I think, is going to take up. There's a couple of stories here involving Zach Brown, CEO at McLaren. And I think this will generate a lot of discussion between the two of us. So let's break now for a breather, and we'll pick it up on the other side. So don't drop your clutch. Don't stall. We'll be back in just a moment. Okay, welcome back. And yes, Zach Brown, CEO of McLaren, he's been in the news this past week for a couple of things. Last week, we spoke at length just at our bemusement, our complete disbelief, like everybody else out there, that the fact that this whole investigation into the shenanigans and the craziness that marked the end of the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix and the fallout after the race still is... Well, I mean, have they even started now? I know it was as of last week that certainly wasn't the case. Anyways, Zach Brown was talking about this this week, and he says that the FIA's report into what happened at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix not only needs to state what he says was right and what was wrong, but also what action will be taken in the future. Now, I think this is good because I'm a big fan of Zach Brown. I think that the job that he's done for McLaren and how he's under his guidance and the people that he's brought into the team has completely reversed their fortunes. And so I think that every time he sits up and says something, then, you know, or he stands up and says something, I really take notice to what he has to say. Anyways, Brown had to say, quote, "I think with all controversies in sport, in time, as soon as the next season starts, the wounds start to heal. But I do think that the FIA needs to come out with a here's what happened and here's how and why we think it happened. Here's what was right. Here's what was wrong. And whatever they're going to come out with in the report and then show that they've taken action to make sure it doesn't happen again." End quote. So absolutely, I think that's 100% what happens. Needs to happen. But he does go on with a further quote, and he denied any hints or suggestions of a conspiracy against either Lewis or Mercedes. Anyways, he had to say, quote, "I don't think this was a malicious decision. So for those that might have a view that the sport's corrupt, etc., I don't agree with that. Do I think potentially a different decision could have been made? Yes, probably. But I want to wait to see what the FIA comes out with. I think we've all seen in sport before, referees make decisions that people disagree with. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong." End quote. And yes, I completely agree with that. I don't think it was a malicious decision, as Zach Brown says. Like we talked about for many, many weeks afterwards, that they were stuck in an awkward position, and it was just awkward the way that they tried to resolve the race. And obviously, it's had huge fallouts. But the core of this, this quote from Zach Brown is that they have to be completely transparent about it, right? They have to say, this is why it happened, why we think it happened, this was right, this is wrong, and this is what we're going to do to prevent it from happening in the future. I mean, that's basically what he says in a nutshell, and I think that's exactly what they need to do.
And I think what fans will be looking for, and I think what other teams will be looking for, is whether the FIA is willing to demonstrate some degree of grace and humility here, because that's not what's happened so far. And I think that ill-conceived release shortly after the events of December 12th, where they suggested that the confusion and frustration stemmed from quote unquote a misunderstanding, or the fact that fans were misunderstanding the rules, which clearly weren't applied, just kind of fueled the fire. So I think I agree with everything Zach says, and I'm becoming a bigger fan of Zach by the day. And every time I see him quoted in an article, I pause and I read, because I generally really like the way that he articulates himself.
Yep.
I like his position on most subjects. I think, well, it's good that finally there's some movement, and the FIA had to come out last week just to remind us that, hey, okay, we're going to do this report that we'd committed to doing. Now we're going to start. It's kind of shocking that they're going to release it on the Friday of the Bahrain Grand Prix weekend, which I didn't realize, and I know I'm probably the last one to pick up on this, but they're releasing that report on Friday. the day, the Friday of the Grand Prix weekend. So rather than releasing it in January or February, they are going to wait till the Grand Prix weekend. So if I'm Liberty and I'm the teams, I'm going to be pretty frustrated because this is, and that's the weekend that's supposed to see a sprint race as well, that you're setting this weekend up to be this exciting celebration of Formula One. We're back. We're introducing the new era, the new regulations. Oh, and by the way, here's the report for everyone to dissect and talk about and argue about for the entire weekend. Seems very, very strange that Liberty would allow F1 to kind of overshadow their marquee season opening event like that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like you say, they must be really frustrated about that because that's just going to reignite the whole discussion because I can't imagine this was a highly divisive incident, right? I mean, to put it mildly, Lewis fans were angry, Max fans were happy. But like I said last week, I mean, even if you're the most hardcore Max Verstappen fan, somewhere deep down, you must be feeling, you must recognize that, hey, this could have gone the other way. This could have been Max out front and he could have been robbed. I mean, just from the way, like an operating point of view, the way that Formula One is won, that, I mean, if this doesn't bother you, on some level, regardless of where your loyalties lie with regardless which team or which driver, if this doesn't bug you in some way, then honestly, I don't know why you're watching this sport, because it bothers me a lot, it bothers you a lot, and it bothers everybody else. Regardless if you're the most hardcore Lewis fan or not, you should have an issue with the way that this went down. And like I said last week, I mean, Max beat him fair and square on the track, but it's the whole circumstances that led up to those last couple of laps. That's what the debate is about, and rightly so. And that's what they need to come down and or really drill down on and come out with. This is why it happened, and this is how we can prevent it from happening in the future, because it shouldn't happen again. Because it was bad enough it happened one time, but if it happened again in the future, I mean, not only does your sport have a bit of a tarnish on it now it's got a massive crisis and a serious credibility problem, and then they could see like a mass exodus of fans at that point, right? Okay, now let's move on to the next one. So Zach, still talking about these operational portions of Formula One, he was talking now about stewards, and this is a discussion that you and I have had a good many times over the months. Anyways, Zach had to say, quote, "I wouldn't want to be a referee in any sport. It's no different than in football. Did he trip him up? Did he not? Did he throw an elbow or not throw an elbow? There's a lot of subjectivity to these calls. There could be better judgment calls made, but I don't think you're ever going to get it up 100% right, and I don't think you do in any sport. Otherwise, the football fans don't have someone to yell at when they see a call, which inevitably goes according to, was it your team that the call went for or against? It's the lack of consistency. I think more full-time stewards would help, because I think the stewards are doing the best they can with the flying in and out. Some of them are there a lot, some are less. IndyCar pretty much has full-time stewards, so I think that is part of the solution," end quote. And, you know, I don't really have anything to add there. I mean, this is basically what you and I would both like to see. However, neither of us combined even, and I know this is a bit of a mind blower, but even combined, you and I do not have the, let's just say the presence Zach Brown obviously has, and he's obviously a voice that that if he's saying something, then people should be listening to him that make these decisions.
Yeah, stewarding and the way that stewarding is conducted is expected to be addressed in the FIA's ongoing analysis. So that report that we just spoke to a couple of minutes ago, there should be a section, or it's expected that there'll be a subsection within that document that makes some recommendations around the stewarding process. And there's some stats here that I pulled out of an article, a great article from therace.com. And I'm just going to quote the article here. Verbatim. "During 2021, a total of 41 different people acted as FIA stewards across the 22 race weekends."
Wow.
41 different people. "Each stewarding panel usually, but not always, comprises four members, including one of the available pool of four chairmen, one steward nominated by the National Sporting Authority, and two other FIA-appointed stewards. Since 2010, one of those FIA-appointed stewards has been the driver stewards. These are usually ex-F1 drivers, although during 2021, sports car legend Tom Tom Christensen, who tested F1 machinery but never started a Grand Prix, was used on two occasions. Mm-hmm. The stewards are also supported by a comprehensive database of past incidents and decisions that allow easy access to various precedents, which is a means to increase the consistency of their decisions. There has been resistance to the idea of permanent stewards in F1. Last year, for example, race director Michael Massey said that this was because of fear of what he called, quote unquote, perceived bias when there is a permanent steward. Now, Zach Brown goes on to indicate and has spoken to the fact as well that it might be very difficult to recruit somebody to do this full time. It's very much a thankless job. And if I'm a former Formula One driver, do I really want to sign up to a 8, 16, 20, 22, 23 race commitment to stewarding where, quite frankly, you are always in the spotlight and your decisions will always be challenged? So I agree, full-time professional stewards, absolutely required. Getting somebody to commit to that, I think, is going to prove more complicated. Getting somebody who is qualified to commit to that is going to be more challenging.
You know, I still think that we have to see, like we see in North American sports, where you have like officiating crews, right? You have the same crew for the NFL or the NBA, whatever it is that, you know, so I don't see at this point with the amount of money that they're pulling in that they don't establish like stewarding you and train qualified people that already have a background in motorsport, in racing, and get them to that level. And then, you know, maybe the commitment is obviously going to be a lot easier instead of like sending the same people over and over and over again. You have a pool of people and you can get them to go to whichever races, or, I mean, it'd obviously be a lot easier in these, say, double or triple header weekends. It's like, okay, well, you're doing this race and this race, right? You show up for this race, you fly off to the next one, or whatever it is. I mean, the logistics of it are a little bit to be on the scope of this conversation. However, I think the core of the conversation still remains is why are, you know, like, what's holding them back? Like, I find that that quote from Massey that he thinks that there's a potential bias for people, you know, if they have like regular people doing it, but, or appointed people. I'm not sure exactly the way he's kind of going at it. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, the pool of people, you know, regardless, it's fairly small. So, I mean, I don't really see that as like a real argument, because regardless if they're trained or full time, I mean, you're still pulling people from the same, you know, small pool. So what does it matter if they're full time or just like one off? I mean, you know, I don't see the potential of bias being a reason not to do it. I think that, you know, it's completely the reverse case.
Totally agree.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on. We're going to talk now about the Mercedes. And if you are a fan of one of the other nine teams, you're probably maybe shaking and nervous a little bit, because apparently the new W13 is going to be boosted by a brand new turbocharger. And I mean, the one thing I think we can safely say about Mercedes over the past, basically decade, is that these cars have not been underpowered. Anyways, it's kind of interesting too, because you know, we've got these new E10 fuel coming in, and that's going to be 10% of the fuel mixture will actually come from new renewable resources. Anyways, it's predicted that perhaps this is going to lead to a reduction in up to 20%, or sorry, 20 horsepower, not 20%, but a 20 horsepower deficit. And it's interesting that this the new fuel would actually do that. But however, anytime that you hear that Mercedes has upgraded any component on their car, I think if you're one of the other teams, you're automatically going to be a little bit concerned about that. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it's one of those things where the other teams are kind of rolling their eyes. I also, and I apologize, because I should know better, because I like to take some pride in being able to bring some technical prowess to this podcast. I thought that Mercedes had performed a turbocharger upgrade either before or during the previous campaign, which would have meant that that part would now be frozen. So I'm guessing they didn't, or maybe I misunderstood the regulation, because of course the power units that the teams are going to bring into 2022 have to be frozen. And they were allowed to perform some limited upgrades to certain components throughout 2021. But once they had updated and modified those certain components, then that engine basically became frozen and you couldn't do anything with that engine now between 2022 and 2025, except for updates that might improve reliability. And again, as Bryson says, there's a very fine line between doing updates and tweaks to improve reliability that don't ultimately improve performance. But I also was of the impression that this part had been upgraded during the season. So it's interesting that, you know, Mercedes is still in a position where they're deploying parts that should presumably add some additional power to the car.
Well, you know, that is always that sort of like age-old discussion about, reliability improvements and upgrades, like you just mentioned, and that's where it becomes interesting in Formula One. I know it's all about the rules and the regulations, but it is fascinating that they are sometimes able to find these loopholes in the rules and really exploit them to their advantage, and come up with a winning design on whatever it might be. But so we'll be watching that obviously, and we're going to take one final break, and then we got a bunch of like real quick hits that we're going to close the show out with. So guys, don't go away. We will be back again, and we will go home at some point, but anyways, first a short break. We'll be back in a moment. Don't go away. Okay, and welcome back. So the first story is kind of a back to the future, or maybe a back to the past. It's a retro story. Anyways, Formula One this season is going back to 90-minute practice sessions, which yes. is, they went from 90 minutes down to 60, but now this is being reversed, which to me makes a lot of sense. You seem very excited about this one, so why don't you take it away, Mark?
I'm probably less excited about it now than I was earlier. To me, it's like an extra 60 minutes of Formula One. But one of the reasons that they cut it back, other than the fact that we were in the middle of a pandemic and they were looking to cut costs, was one of the criticisms of Free Practice 1 and 2, which have historically been 90 minutes long, and Free Practice 3 on the Saturday is only 60 minutes long. One of the reasons they cut it back was because they simply made for the crappiest viewing experience ever, because you would have, at times, no cars on the track. So people are tuning in to watch practice and there's nothing happening. So the thought was, hey, if we slice 30 minutes off, the car team still want to get the same number of laps in, but the track's going to be busier. So maybe it's a 60-minute viewing experience, but there's more going on. And that's actually exactly what happened. So, you know, as much as I'd like to see 90 minutes, I also don't think the teams were necessarily taking advantage of the time allocated to them, and the cars were spending way too much time in the garage. And it really sucked if you tuned in watching free practice when you should be working and there's no one on the track for 7 minutes at a time. So you know what? Yeah. Again, it's cool. It's cool if you're trackside and you get to experience it. But I think from a TV viewing experience, 60 minutes is way better.
Yeah, totally. But I don't actually mind so much. I don't really get too much of a chance to tune into the practice sessions. Like, if I was working at home, I might have it running on in the background. And if something interesting seemed to be happening, I kind of toggle between browsers or whatever, see what was going on. But practice is the opportunity for them to get the cars dialed in and figure out what's going on and all these good sorts of things. So, you know, I think from that point of view, I think it's a good one. So next story, Formula One's new rules theoretically will cut the gap between the front and back half of the grid. So anyways, they believe that the equation of restrictive aero rules plus the cost cap should actually cut the gap between the front and back of the grid after only a year. So this remains to be seen, but in theory, it's a great thing. But again, I mean, we are just going to sit here and speculate about it. I mean, we can look at models, we can look at data, we can look at all these things, but until we see these cars all lined up and we see them get all the kinks ironed out with all these new untested and untried cars, that it's all unproven. We all hope for the best, but we don't know whether or not this is going to pan out in reality.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to this other than the fact that everything, all the heavy lifting, all of the pain that Formula One's gone through over the last couple of years is to get to a state where there isn't as big a spread amongst the teams on the track come Grand Prix Sunday. If we don't see something significant, I think it's going to be a resounding disappointment. But that said, I also know that some teams are going to, despite everything I said earlier about the fact that the formulas are designed now to prevent cases where teams are way off the mark or to enable teams from getting way too far ahead.
Yeah.
I think there's still going to be a little bit of room. And it's one of the reasons that the FIA and Formula One have agreed to keep DRS in the sport, because they're not confident that every team's going to hit the formula just right in year one. And it might take a couple of years. But sure. If we did see the spread, if we saw the gap halved in year one, that would be a huge, huge accomplishment.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I agree. And the FIA's head of single seaters, Nicholas Tombazis, said, quote, "I think that currently the best to worst team gap is probably about 3 seconds, depending on the circuit. I hope that after maybe a year, we will have less than half of that. That is what I would hope, but we'll have to see," end quote. So, I mean, if you're like Haas or Williams, I mean, you're only slightly less crappy than you were prior to the introduction of the rules. Because, I mean, let's face it. I mean, okay, it doesn't look good, or it hasn't looked good the way that it's been in the previous formula. But let's be realistic. I mean, if you're still a second and a half off the pace, I mean, that's still a huge, huge gap between yourself and the fastest car. Second and a half, that's a country mile in Formula One terms.
Yeah, and it's the best way to look at this is it's not a second and a half a lap. Think about it over a race distance, right? If you're running 70 laps and you are a second and a half off of the pack, you are going to be lapped, and Formula One cannot continue to live in a world where cars and teams are consistently lapped. And it's not as bad as it was in 2014. And Tim Haraney talked about this. Like, Lewis and Nico were lapping everyone up to fourth, fifth place.
Yep.
They were almost lapping third place cars. Like, we just can't live in that world anymore. And a second and a half in isolation doesn't seem crazy, but when you spread that over a race distance, it's just absurd, and we can't live in that world anymore.
Yeah, exactly right. And well, I mean, like I was just saying, I mean, it isn't proven yet. We all hope for the best, but certainly, I mean, some of it's on the rules, some of it's on the teams themselves, but I mean, the fact is you're always going to have fast cars and slower cars, but it just, like you say, it doesn't look great if the best cars are lapping basically everybody else but themselves. Okay, moving on to this one. This has a bit of a tie-in to the Australian Open tennis tournament and Novak Djokovic and that whole saga about his non-vaccination and then his whole fight to stay in Australia before ultimately being deported. So Formula One drivers and teams have been told to vaccinate or stay at home. And so they're insisting on 100% vaccine compliance. If anybody within the Formula One, bubble, circuit, group, whatever you want to call it, you know, wants to enter the country. Now, the good part about this is, despite not having an Australian Grand Prix for the past couple of years, because, you know, I hope that I'm not just every time I think about Formula One, I think about the pandemic that I'm going to, because I mean, basically for me, the pandemic started when the Australian Grand Prix got canceled back in the spring of 2020.
Yeah,
that's
agree.
When life
Same.
Changed was that yep. bloody weekend.
That was the oh crap moment. That oh crap.
Pretty much,
it's
right?
It's just become real.
Yeah, that's when realities came up and smashed us all in the face. But, you know, at least we are 2 years later. So the Victorian government and Formula One are committed on both sides to see that the Australian Grand Prix goes ahead as planned from April 7th to 10th, following a 2 year absence, which, you know, is not unusual considering all the other races and other venues that have not been able to hold a Formula One race during COVID. But, you know, I'm really, encouraged by this. And I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that you should be vaxxed or not vaxxed, and that's not the discussion. I mean, they've decided that, you know, for them, this is what we want. If you want to come, you know, if you want to get a vaccine, then get your vaccine. If you don't want to, that's fine. You don't have to, but you just can't come to Australia. You're not going to be able to participate in the Grand Prix. And that doesn't matter if you're making sandwiches in the team motorhome or you're Lewis Hamilton, you're Max Verstappen, and I'm not commenting. I don't know what their vax status is, but you know what I'm saying? It doesn't matter where you are. If you're one of the drivers or one of the support staff, that if you want to come and participate, you have to be vaccinated. I think that just makes sense. You know, you can't have any loopholes if, you're the authorities there. It's either just like one way, or, you know, you either enforce it or you don't. And I think that it just kind of makes sense. So hopefully we don't see any high profile names there, but we'll see. But I think that at this point, they've all had their vax at this point, haven't they?
Well, we know they are, right? Because they wouldn't have been able to get into Bahrain, the Kingdom of Saudi
Arabia.
Oh, true.
Great point. Yes.
So yeah, that was kind of a litmus test. And I think there was probably a little bit of nervousness as they were heading back to the Middle East at the end of last season. Like, but it looks like it was smooth. So everyone understands it shouldn't be a problem. I would add that the Djokovic situation was a really bad look for Australia. And I love Australia, but the political infighting, the fact that the prime minister was pointing his finger at the state of Victoria and blaming them for the fact that he was able to get in wasn't a good look. Now, separate from the COVID discussion, one of our longtime listeners, Joe, who actually moved to Australia right at the onset of the pandemic, announced on Spaces tonight that he has grandstand tickets for Melbourne Grand Prix. So
cool.
Super excited for him. We also learned on Spaces tonight that Jen has tickets to Miami. So some of our listeners getting set up. Oh, and also Micah, who was on the Spaces chat tonight, announced that he has tickets for Silverstone. So we
that
have
is awesome.
Listeners traveling all over the world to see Grand Prix. So knock on wood that everything goes smoothly for them and they have an excellent time.
Well, I mean, at least for Australia, the Australian Grand Prix Corporation boss, Andrew Westacott, said, quote, "We've got a commitment from the Victorian government that the event's going ahead. We've got a commitment from Formula One that they're coming here for round three. We're selling tickets like hotcakes and we're 80 days away from the event. So everything is happening. Everything is getting ready. And I can't wait to host the best drivers in the world in new cars on a new track," end quote. And let's not forget that Albert Park is one of these tracks that's been modified. It's been reprofiled and really
awesome
looking
call.
Forward to see what what the changes are. And you know, we've seen it work at other tracks over the past year and a half that have made changes to it. And I'm really excited to it because, I mean, let's be fair. It hasn't always been the most exciting racing at Albert Park over the years. So I'm really hoping the changes that they made really work to it because, it's a beautiful venue. It is one of the places I'd like to go most to go watch a Formula One race. I mean, it's one of the places, Australia is a place I'd love to go and visit, period. But it's just a stunning location to host a race. And I just can't wait to see Formula One get back there and just... Well, what about 2.5 months? Can't come quick enough. All right. Couple last stories. Well, Helmut Marko, well, he's always one to kind of say whatever is on his mind, which sometimes can kind of trigger people. Anyways, Helmut says that there's, including you, Helmut believes that 2022 will see the battle between Red Bull and Mercedes pick up where it left off after last year. Well, I don't know if it can pick up exactly where it left off, considering how the last season ended, how the last race ended, but at least, from the level of a competitiveness, you know, we've seen some great moments between Red Bull and Mercedes over the past year or so. I would love to see Max and Lewis go at it again. I mean, as long as it doesn't get too crazy and too insane. I mean, there was a number of flashpoints in the 2021 season, even before we got to Abu Dhabi. But, just on the point of watching one win and the other win kind of go back and forth all season long. I mean, take away Silverstone, take away Imola, take away the craziness that we saw at Saudi. And then, of course, I would just rather forget those last 5 or 6 laps and the fallout from Abu Dhabi. You know, I really feel that it was, it was obviously not the way that we wanted to, the note that we wanted to end that season on, but however, no need breaking that down, but, bring it to sort of full circle. I would love to see the two of them go at it again, but I would also love to see somebody else throw themselves into that mix as well. You know, a Ferrari or a McLaren or maybe one of these other teams that can maybe sort it out and become a contender. What do you think, Mark? Yeah. Okay. You completely.
So, it's funny because typically you hand it over to me and you take a breath and you look at your watch as I go on to like a 19-minute soliloquy. But yeah, I don't have a lot more to add on that one.
Okay. Well, why don't we wrap it up there? You know, I think that we've kind of gone on for long enough.
I do have one piece.
Oh, you did have one more piece.
I promise I'll make this quick. So 99.99999% of our interactions with the F1 community are unbelievably supportive.
Sure.
But there is an individual recently that has been hounding and hounding and hounding and blaming us for the fact that Nancy Pelosi got elected. I promise you that neither Mark nor I voted for Nancy Pelosi. Neither of us have U.S. passports, and nor do we try to make this show even remotely political. But I thought it was funny because I'm like, do I send this person like a photograph of my Canadian and British passports? Like, I don't have a U.S. passport, and if I'd wanted to, I couldn't have voted for anyone in that election.
You know, and you'll put that aside that neither of us are American citizens nor can vote in an election in the USA. You know, even if we did, I wouldn't be divulging my political affiliations on the show here. I mean,
exactly.
Heaven forbid I show up wearing a Mercedes shirt or a Red Bull hat or a Ferrari something or ever. I mean, wait a minute. You know, I mean, we've all, you know, both of us have, you know, like donned various bits of team apparel from time to time, and we got called out for it. We got put on blast, especially when we started live streaming these shows. So, you know, I would not go a level further and take it completely out of the realm of Formula One, especially into the, you know, the hot water of politics and things like that. But you know, that's a strange one. That's a strange one.
I feel like we do a pretty good job of walking that straight line about ensuring that people that are tuning in for this show, they're here. They're here for Formula One. They're here because Formula One represents entertainment, and it offers a reprieve and a break from everything else that's going on in the chaotic world. And you know what? Both of us have some deeply held political and social beliefs, and I strongly believe we're both very, very modern and progressive in most of our views. But our perspective and our goal isn't to politicize this show, because that's not why people are tuning in. And Formula One, for us, like I think it is for so many people listening at home, is an opportunity to escape. It's escapism. It's a tool to get away from the hustle and bustle and stresses of modern life. And I think if you feel that we don't do it enough, or you feel that we do it too much, that's kind of our position.
Yeah, you know, and occasionally, you know, I get emails, and you get messages too from people that say, you know, you're too pro Mercedes, or you're too pro Red Bull or something, and that's fair enough. I can totally agree with that from time to time, because both you and I, we sometimes get caught up in the emotion, and sometimes we let our emotions and, you know, our feelings kind of like take things away, and sometimes we do, you know, maybe take more pro stance for one driver or team or another. We try to do our best job. But I have to laugh, because years ago, I guess this would have been 2018. I think this is when I was doing the the show either by myself or with Kevin at the time. And I came out at the beginning of the year after Ferrari had a decent 2017. And I said, you know, this is the year I want to see Ferrari come out strong. I'm throwing, I'm going all in with Sebastian Vettel. I want to see Seb win the championship. I want to see him take it to Lewis. I want to see him take it to Mercedes. And he did a pretty good job up until about halfway. And then, you know, things started to unravel. And then, you know, he started to do some silly things and get involved in some incidents that he shouldn't have, shouldn't found himself in. And at one point, I got extremely critical about him. And I even said during my monologue or my rant at the time that, you know, if you're a four-time world champion and you do something unbecoming of a four-time world champion on this show, you're going to get put on blast. I'm going to call you out.
I love it.
And then, you know, I was going back, and then I had a message, oh, you've got a new review on Apple Podcasts or something like that. And this one guy's like, this guy clearly hates Sebastian Vettel. This is the worst podcast ever. He's totally anti-Ferrari, totally anti-Sebastian Vettel. I'm like, well, obviously this is a guy that just listened to one show, because, you know, I've been pumping Seb's tires all season long, and I had to laugh about that because I'm like, you know what? And regardless, if you're a one-time world champion or a four or five, seven-time world champion of Lewis Hamilton, you know, if you do something unbecoming of somebody with that sort of resume, then you're going to be coming in for a little bit of extra criticism. And also on the flip side, sometimes I tend to be a little bit too generous with the praise as well sometimes. But, I try to keep it as level as possible.
I think you would probably agree with this, but I feel that above all, before we're a Lewis fan, before we're a Max fan, before we're a Red Bull fan, before we're a Mercedes fan.
We're Nancy fans Pelosi fans. I got it.
Oh, man. I was going to say we're man, you cut that in perfectly. Yes. We are Formula One fans, and we just want what's best for the sport.
Totally.
That doesn't mean that we can't talk about how passionately we feel about Williams and how much we want to see them recover. It doesn't mean we can't talk about the fact that we love Lewis, but we would love to see a new world champion. It doesn't mean that our opinions can't evolve. And, you know, it's funny, last year, you and I were so criticized for the first 4 months of the season for being Red Bull homers. And then 2 months later, we were being criticized for being Red Bull haters. But, you know, our opinions evolve. But above all, we just want what's best for the sport, before a team, before a driver. Yeah. We want what's best for the sport.
You know, and sometimes that's a bit of a trick, right? Because, I mean, you nail it when you say that at the heart of it, at our core, we're both Formula One fans, and as difficult as it is sometimes to remain neutral, you know, sometimes our own personal loyalties and, you know, like our own, you know, being a fan, sometimes that percolates up to the surface because, you know, we try to keep it as neutral as possible, you know, to varying success or failure, depending on your point of view, because we realize that if we come out and say, oh, you know what, Max, he nailed it. Yeah, he totally deserved that race in Abu Dhabi. I mean, that's just going to inflame the community, you know, like, and that's going to just spark off, you know, and some people like doing that. Some people like to be the one person that sets the world on fire, right? So, I mean, we try to keep these things in check, but sometimes, you know, like I say, sometimes these things sort of percolate up to the top, and sometimes we get excited about it because sometimes when you get a great race, I mean, it's hard not to get, you know, it's hard not to relive the excitement when you're talking about it, especially when we sit down literally an hour or two after the race is over and record the podcast. Sometimes space is the best thing you can do it, but, you know, if you wait a couple of days to kind of sober up and let your emotions settle, everybody's moved on. Nobody cares about what happened on Sunday because we're halfway through the next news cycle. But anyways, it's all good. Anyways, my friend, I think we've come to the end of it. Anything else for this week, or is it time to start packing everything away and turn off
start
the lights?
Turning off those lights. All right.
That's right. Okay. Well, we're going to leave it there. Guys, thank you so very much for downloading, listening to the show. Thank you for all of you that joined in us on YouTube tonight. Joined us on YouTube tonight. Anyways, if you want to get in touch, by all means, send us a tweet at ScuderiaF1Pod. Send us an email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. That's a wrap. Enjoy the weekend. Mark and I will be back this time next week. That's it. That's a wrap. Take care. Have a good one, everybody. Bye for now.